This Week in Retronauts. Hi, everyone, and welcome to yet another fabulous episode of Retronauts, the official old podcast for official old people. I am this week's host, Jeremy Parrish, and with me this week to talk about such things as the PlayStation's 20th anniversary, we have such luminaries as...
Bob Mackie, also old.
And coming here representing Sony, though not officially speaking for Sony...
Why are you so tied up in being as old? Why are we old? Why are we ancient? We're not old, Jeremy. We're... new and exciting.
Sure. Who are you?
I am Shane Bentenhausen.
Shane does not accept his age. The rest of us do. It's fine. It's okay. You don't have to. Okay, this is an old podcast for old people, but you can tell yourself that you are young.
It's You're fine. Young at heart, Jeremy. We all are.
Yes. Anyway, so I guess the question to ask yourself is, where were you when the Shuttle Challenger blew up?
Actually, you're even going to go there. It's kind of a depressing day, but it was a snow day. It was, you know, January 1986, and I was at home eating cereal.
I don't know. I was in Texas. We didn't have the snow days.
It was a snow day. I was at home eating cereal. It was really depressing. Wow. Watching it.
I was at the launch pad. Don't tell anybody.
Wow.
Hey.
Were you even born?
I was born. I was
you're
born
like
in 82.
One year old.
I was born in 82. Okay. Come on. Give me some credit.
I'll say, in 1986, did any of us have any idea that Sony would one day enter the home console race? Probably not.
Sony? I didn't even know who they were.
I did. We had a Sony TV at my house.
Oh, okay. We didn't because we weren't rich.
neither were we. We just
speaking
had a good,
from a place of privilege.
We had must good, be nice.
We had one good electronic. I think our stereo was like Zenith or something.
I was going to say Zenith was my TV.
Yeah, we had a lot of Zenith. Yeah.
Quasar.
Unlike their name, they were not the
Admiral.
Zenith, right?
Admiral. Craig.
Anyway,
I just scored on Zenith and you guys missed it.
What?
It's fine.
You scored?
Are
we playing Wars with Friends?
You scored with Zenith?
I scored with Zenith. Okay, let's move on.
Anyway, so theoretically, we're here to talk about the 20th anniversary of the PlayStation's launch in America, which happened September 9th, 1995.
Yes,
and it is now, I guess this episode is going to go out in September 2015.
Because so you didn't really celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Japanese launch, which was in 1994.
Right.
Right.
It was a busy year last year.
Okay. I believe there was like one of the first Retronauts episodes was the PlayStation, but that was almost 9 years ago.
Yeah, that was like the 10th anniversary. Well, hootenanny.
That was the PS3 launch like tie-in.
Dear God.
I will say, you know, company,
I'm a historian of Retronauts on the podcast.
Not to
way.
Be the company man.
Someone knows the past.
I don't want to be
show.
The company man carrying the flag, but I did think it was actually really phenomenally awesome last December that we did get our stuff together and had the PlayStation experience and had the special 20th anniversary launch PlayStation for the fans. It was like, you know, it's rare.
I wouldn't know. I wasn't invited to the PlayStation.
You were.
But I'll say, like, just in general, it is rare for a hardware manufacturer to actually do the thing that the fans want them to do on the anniversary, whether it's, you know, like Sega or Nintendo or whoever, like to actually deliver.
That anniversary PS4 was pretty sweet, but also it sold out in 20 seconds.
Well, but they are reproducing the controller and the headset at least this fall, so you can buy them normally. But the thing itself is still not available. But
actually, what I want is a PS4 that looks like the Nintendo PlayStation prototype, complete with a yellow plastic. That would be fantastic.
It was amazing how that thing that recently got unearthed did have the same weird cigarette smoke yellowed plastic as the Super Nintendo.
I assume it was built from the same plastic.
Was that a hoax? I didn't follow up on
it. No, allegedly that is a real shell. It's just a working
prototype. Are you allowed to say that?
I think that came out.
Because Shu Yoshida was like, that's pretty interesting, huh? But I like that there's some mystery to it.
Oh, well.
You might have just broken the company line, son.
The thing that the pictures of is not something that we have. But I thought I'd heard a third-party source saying that it was confirmed as just a prototype shell. It never went to manufacture.
I mean,
it doesn't function.
It looks very, very similar to some renders that I've seen. Like, there are some minor differences. Like, the supposed prototype has, like, three audio plugs in the front.
Right.
And the render or the image from Edge magazine or Next Gen only had like one, but it's very similar. So if it's not legit, it's a great mock-up.
Yeah, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit in that you're even talking about this thing existing. But Shuhei Yoshida, head of Worldwide Studios, did say to Eurogamer or somebody last week that like he has, you know, a thing like this that does function and he has games for it. And like that's been one of the things internally is like if we ever – I've never got to see that. But I'm sure it would be like the Sony ImageSoft games that were being made probably, at that time. Yeah. Not like, it's not
hey, it's Hook for CD.
Right. Yeah. It's like, or someone was joking. I think it was 8-4. They're like, oh, it's going to be like Three Ninjas Kick Back. You know, or like, it's more likely Mickey Mania or something. But it's not like you're going to find like, oh man, like Crash Bandicoot versus Mario or something.
No, no.
You know,
it's totally going to be ImageSoft. But right. that is something worth discussing is the fact that there's all this like history and weirdness. And
well, I mean, are we going to get into the very beginnings of this with like the Philips partnership falling apart? Or where does this begin?
Yeah. I mean, I think the story goes, let's see, where did my notes begin? The prehistory, 1987, actually. So 1987 was the roundest part of the Famicom bubble, the Japanese bubble economy. The NES was just starting to find traction in the U.S., and Sony, a really well-respected and liked premium electronics manufacturer. They had invented the Walkman. They had invented some really cool stuff in the 70s. They helped invent the CD standard. It's 1987. It's been a couple of years since their last big hit. So they enter the video game market. And Epic Sony Records publishes Tokoro-san no Mamoru mo Sumeru mo, which I have no idea what that means. But it was a Famicom game developed by HAL. So Sony entered video games, publishing for Famicom publisher.
Through Sony Music.
Through Sony Music. That's the important part. It was not Sony's electronics division that entered. Like a lot of Japanese companies in the late 80s, it was the publishing, the media right. side. Well, you had like Pony Canyon.
Right,
you had
my favorite Meldak, the jazz label.
Meldak, Victor.
Victor, JVC.
RCA, yep. Yeah. Yep. So like you had a lot of these companies that had very large music libraries. They had, you know, distribution. They were established as media distribution companies. And they all looked at the Famicom explosion and said, yeah, we want in on that.
And I think by 87 in America, it was clear. It was a kind of like, you know, ascending quickly.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would say 1988 was when the NES was like
peaked.
Man.
Yeah.
But 87 was the Christmas that it was impossible yep. to find the NES. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was definitely an ascendant, as you say, yep. business here in the US. So clearly it was a big deal around the world, and it made sense for media companies to want in on it. Sony didn't have development studios internally, so it published works by other established developers, such as HAL.
I will say internally, I did once see a presentation that was like the presentation internally to create Sony Computer Entertainment, which is pretty amazing. But like that they gave to Ken Kutaragi to like create SCE.
And like, when did that actually happen? When was Sony Computer Entertainment established?
It's the very very early 90s, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that would have happened around the time of the Sony PlayStation development.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So Sony, the music label, entered the video games industry. But that was the entree, shall we say, of the company into video games. And, you know, everything kind of started from that tiny and let's be honest, kind of sad acorn. Mm-hmm. There were not a lot of good early Sony published games. There were some. They published Super Dodgeball. Sony ImageSoft's first game was Super Dodgeball, developed by Technos
which was
called.
A good game. You know, yeah. It had the Kunio kind of look to it. And,
oh, it was a Kunio game.
But, you know, what's weird, all those early Sony games, there was no cohesiveness to them. You know, they were all just pickups,
yeah,
kind of.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, they were very much targets of opportunity. They said, here is a game that we should publish in Japan, or here is a game we should publish in America, or both.
They did seem to be picking up fairly good stuff, though, like things like Smart Ball, right? You know, or...
you mean Jelly Boy?
Jelly Boy. Or
I think his name is Jerry Boy.
Jerry Boy. you know, or even like, I guess their original stuff like Hook, if we get to that, it's pretty good, actually.
Hook's not bad, yeah.
Not bad.
Made by the guy who did Skyblazer.
Okay, yeah. That's right. Yeah, we talked about that on the Skyblazer episode.
Yeah, I forget what the name of the developer was, but yeah, Skyblazer was their other
You know, it is kind of like Virgin at the time. They were trying to like make better games too. They did cool spot. Like, I felt like, as just a fan of games back then, I was like 12 or 13, like the Sony ImageSoft games, they weren't there with like, you know, the Capcoms and the Konamis and Nintendos of the world, but like they weren't bad. They weren't like the garbage
some
you
of them,
avoided.
Some of them were pretty bad. Cliffhanger was not good.
Cliffhanger. The Sega CD Cliffhanger, I remember I rented it because it had amazing snowboarding sequences.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. That's also why people rented Final Fantasy VII.
It's also true. That's why I did.
But like I guess early on.
They were all over the place.
They seem opportunistic but not terrible initially, I think.
you know, they were like a lot of publishing conglomerates just sort of figuring out what works.
I would say it was like a mixed bag. I didn't expect quality from the little feather logo,
that's
but
a gaming
occasionally,
journalist cliche, sir.
Hey, I'm reinventing it. I'm bringing it back.
It is interesting though. They got the Mickey Mania. Like getting a Mickey Mouse license is kind of interesting.
They didn't do Mickey Mania. That was Capcom. Or did they do it?
No,
in Japan?
They did Mickey Mania. They are the
Mickey Mania. I was thinking Mickey
not
Mouse
the Magical Cave. Quest or Mickey Mouse Cave. They are the publisher of record of Mickey Mania by David Jaffe, mind you. And it is that is probably like
is that the only game where Mickey says fuck?
No, he does not say that. But I think that is one of their final games. And I think that it was one of the games that they were like, that was meant to be a PlayStation game, I believe.
Hmm. Interesting. So yeah, that was 1987 that Sony entered the publishing business for video games, and actually their video game business took off in earnest, at least internally, in 1988. That's when Sony began to collaborate with Nintendo on the Super NES CD, at least according to several of the sources that I.
That early, really, as early as 1988.
Yeah, 1988, which makes sense because, you know, the Super NES launched in 1990 in Japan, and the Super NES had the Yamaha Sony-developed music chip inside of it.
What year was the Turbo CD?
That was 1980. Oh, the CD?
88, 89?
Yeah.
I was trying to think of like
The PC Engine was 87. I think the CD was... It might have been late 88, but it might have been 89.
I knew it was in the 80s. I just, like, there's a precedent for this, you know.
Right.
For a
oh,
CD
yeah,
system.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, I don't think that they immediately said, hey, Nintendo, let's make a CD-ROM system. I think, maybe I'm wrong, but I think, you know, they started developing hardware with Nintendo.
Because I'll say, at this point, in the very late 80s, early 90s, you know, the switch from old media to, you know, CD-ROM media was fairly controversial and, you know, CD-ROMs were so slow. The load times were incredibly slow. It's hard for modern
gamers. And the drives were very expensive,
too. Yeah, it's hard for modern gamers to think about, like, how slow these access times really were. Initial loads could be minutes. Minutes for these games.
But, I mean, that was controversial, but also not totally without precedent because, you know, computers that loaded from old diskettes or from tape cassettes also had that same sort of load time problem. So,
right. Well, but I think for video games, the problem was, you know, we were used
console
to,
games.
For console games, we were used to fast action, fast moving things on screen. And what CD-ROM was good at was like giving you full motion video and Redbook audio and not the kind of things we were used to. Like the first games on CD-ROM really didn't appeal to like the core tenets that we were used to for console games.
I think that was a Nintendo excuse, like we don't want load times in our games. I mean, I'm not sure. It seems a little disingenuous to say this is why we stuck with cartridges when we all know kind of why they did, but that was like what they said as one of their excuses.
Well, I think there is some validity to that. I mean,
I think they wanted to make money off of cartridges still, but
there is that. Yeah, sure. But I think also there were legitimate creative reasons to want to stay with cartridges. I mean, Mario 64 would have been a much less impressive game if every time you jumped into a painting, you had 30 seconds of load time.
I'm thinking of right now Captain Lou Albano FMV for like when you beat the game.
Well, and also, I'll say, as someone who was super into games, when I finally played TurboGrafx 16 CD-ROM or even Sega CD, when I realized that, wait a minute, just being on a CD-ROM doesn't actually make this better.
Right.
It doesn't make the graphics better.
Yeah.
That was kind of, you know, a big thing to realize. I think that's part of Nintendo's realization is had they made the Super Famicom a CD-only system, it would have been a very different beast, you know, obviously.
Well, I don't think they were ever planning to make the Super Famicom Super NES CD-only. I mean, the hybrid console that we've seen, the prototype, supposed prototype, is, you know, like I said, it's a hybrid. It takes cartridges and CDs. And so, you know, it's a lot like the
Mega CD or TurboGrafx.
Yeah, I was going to say the PC Engine Duo, the Turbo Duo, where it's, you know, both it supports both formats. And that probably would have been the way to go with it.
But I think they also had the plan to have it be a optional accessory as well. Not an all, you know, there was going to be an all-in-one unit, but there's going to be an add-on
like,
drive as well.
Right, the basically like a Famicom disk system.
Right.
I mean, that's the way everyone else did it. You had, you know, your Turbo CD, and then you had your Turbo Duo.
So I think that was the plan, to work with Sony, and the Nintendo would actually manufacture all the hardware, right, that Sony wasn't, or would we know that?
I don't know. I assumed that it would be, you know, like each would kind of to his own abilities.
But it wasn't going to be like a Saturn situation where like, oh, JVC made a Saturn, Hitachi made a Saturn, where all these different, right. 3DO.
I mean, you know, Nintendo had experimented with that themselves with the Famicom Twin, the Twin Famicom,
that's right.
Sorry.
Sharp made that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, and then they had, I think they had, wasn't it an NES, a Famicom?
What was
that
the
was
crazy,
built into the television?
Wait, the crazy GameCube that was like garish silver.
The Q?
The Q. Yeah, Panasonic Q. Yeah. That thing.
But that was only for China, wasn't it?
No, that came out in Japan.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. So, you know, there's precedent for that and even, you know, some afterwards. But it definitely wasn't a 3DO kind of situation.
Or my favorite, the Iowa Sega boombox. There was like a Mega Drive that's in an Iowa boombox.
Damn. Well, that's even crazier than the Mega Jet.
It is. Anyway, moving back to the Nintendo PlayStation.
Right. So a lot of this is speculation. But in any case, in 1988, Ken Kutaragi started working with Nintendo. And it was somewhat... It probably wasn't like he went rogue, but it was somewhat off the books. It was something Sony's management reportedly was not super crazy about. They were like, video games, working with Nintendo, we don't know about this. And it turns out their concerns were not unfounded. But so he, you know, worked with Nintendo and he had the support of, I can't remember the executive's name, but there was someone in the company who was like, yeah, what you're doing is cool. You've got the green light on this. Go ahead, make it happen. The first fruit of that relationship to be born was the Super NES sound chip, which in my opinion is probably the best thing about the Super NES hardware.
Yeah, I mean, when I first played Super Nintendo, it blew my mind how good the sound was. And still, when you go back and listen to it now, the awesome like synth strings that come out of the thing, unbelievable.
Yeah, nothing sounds like it,
yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, of course, it also makes remakes of Super NES games kind of impossible and watered down because that chip was such a part of it. And I assume like the sound effects or whatever, the samples are copyrighted by Sony.
Right.
Because it was sample based. It was not a sound generating platform. Nintendo Super NES was a very unusual system because it was not generating electronic tones. It was actually
it was almost
creating
more like,
samples,
like using MIDI samples, kind of.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, yeah. That, it basically was like it was. My understanding is that it was like, you know, it was developed by Sony and Yamaha, and it was basically like using Yamaha's keyboard technology,
right.
Where they would, you know, have audio samples or whatever of, you know, a pipe organ or a piano or an electric guitar or slap bass. There was lots of slap bass on Super NES.
It was so good.
Yep.
Well, and it was also consistent. Like every Super Nintendo sounded the same, whereas Genesis, like the output quality was really different from unit to unit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There were like three different versions of the Sega Genesis sound chip, and some of them are very good and some of them are very
bad. And I'll say the Super Nintendo sounded so good that even sometimes that stuff sounded better than Redbook even just because it was just beautiful. So, yeah.
Yeah,
good,
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I certainly thought so at the time, but in college I had a roommate who was a music major, and whenever I would play, you know, like the Final Fantasy III Kefka's Domain, he'd be like, what is this garbage? This is terrible.
Wow, 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 wow.
Yeah, exactly.
Not the best.
But no, well, I mean, it still sounded great. And, you know, in the hands of a capable composer, like, say, Yuzo Koshiro for Actraiser or whoever did, you know, Super Castlevania IV soundtrack.
Exactly.
Just like it sounded like no other video game. And, of course, you know, developers could augment the samples and the sound with their own additions to the, you know, if they wanted to give some of their cartridge space to that.
Right.
Well, so that was Sony's addition to the Super NES hardware, and it was great.
And I was going
to
add that it's like shortly after Super Famicom started coming out, the information that Sony and Nintendo were working on the CD-ROM drive was kind of out there. It was in EGM. Like I was reading about it as a kid. And
it was in like the first or second issue of EGM.
It was, and I remember like, you know, I knew what Sony was. I knew they were, you know, a respected home electronics corporation that hadn't been in games previously. And I remember thinking, oh, that's cool. Like, I was excited for Sega CD. I wanted TurboGrafx CD. I was like, Nintendo should do one too. It's a good idea. Go Nintendo.
And I have to admit that was all kind of outside of my interest. Like, I wasn't really interested in peripherals, and so I kind of ignored CD systems. So
you did not want to play East Book 1 and 2?
I really...
The first game to ever get a 10 from EGM?
Yeah. So
like, you didn't see a picture of Fina and be like, you're my waifu.
No, I really didn't.
Did we have waifus back then?
No.
We did. Okay. We did.
They were called spousus.
Spousus.
No, I honestly can't say that I looked at, you know, CD-ROM systems and said, yes, I want to spend $300 or $400 of my meager money to have the ability to play some other games. There were enough games on cartridge that I was happy.
So what do you think about Nintendo teaming up with Sony?
It didn't mean anything to me, honestly. I just kind of said, okay, whatever. It's probably something that's going to be expensive and they're going to try to make me buy, but I'm happy with my cards. I can play Bubsy on Super NES, by God, and I don't need a CD add-on for that.
Because I remember I was excited about it, and then when I remember reading in EGM that that deal had somehow fallen apart and that Nintendo was instead partnering with a different, you know, hardware manufacturer, Philips, I was shocked and confused because, like, Philips didn't seem as cool to me as Sony as a kid.
They didn't make Walkman.
And they were in Japanese. And I was like, I knew that, which was interesting. I was like, well, that's kind of weird that they're going with a European company. I wonder what will come of that. And I wonder what will happen with Sony.
Bob, where do you stand on all this? You've been very quiet.
I wasn't really aware of the SNES CD at the time. I was only aware of it in retrospect. And I was reading game magazines in the late 80s, but I was only aware of it when, like, later it was like, oh, did you know that the PlayStation was actually a Super Nintendo peripheral once or whatever? It's like, wow, it's like the easiest game trivia ever. But I remember reading about PlayStation.
You know Super Mario Brothers 2 wasn't actually a Mario game?
It's actually Doki Doki Picnic, but more on that later. No, for this, it was like I read about, like, in EGM in, like, 93 or whatever. It's like, oh, the Japanese have this new console, and it's called the PlayStation. I'm like, oh, that's neat. Like, that's all I thought of it because everybody was having a new console. It was the mid-90s. Everyone needed to have their console to fail. But I didn't expect that little mention to blow up into, like, one of the biggest gaming things ever, really. Phenomenons. Yep.
So, yes, the tragedy happened at CES. Was it CES 1991?
Yeah.
So the Super NES Super Famicom was out in Japan, was coming out soon in America. So this was kind of the time for them to get on their feet on the ground and say, this is the next step for our platform. Like, after you buy our system, you're going to want to buy this other cool thing for it. And Sony came out and said, check it out, the PlayStation. It's a cool hybrid Super NES. It's going to play cartridges and discs. It's going to be amazing. And the next day, Nintendo said, actually, no. We're going to be partnering with Philips. And that I wish, in a way, I had been in the tech press back then, because that I can't even imagine. Like, that
– yeah.
I've never heard of
it's
anything like that.
It's bizarre. And I've never really had a full explanation. Have you? Like, has anybody ever really dug up what happened?
No, I mean, there's speculation. The understanding, the sort of given accepted narrative is that it was a disagreement over licensing and rights. I think the idea was that Nintendo, you know, would continue manufacturing cartridges, which was their bread and butter. Like, they sold systems on the Razor and Blade model. So they'd sell systems, barely break even on those, and then they would sell you software that, of course, licensees had to have manufactured by Nintendo, paid up front. So it was very, very profitable for Nintendo. If it didn't, you know, if a game didn't sell for third parties, then, oh, that's too bad. Nintendo made its cut. You guys need to market harder or something. So Nintendo, you know, that was a very cushy kind of business for them. But apparently Sony was part of their arrangement was that they would be taking a cut. Either they would be manufacturing CDs themselves and applying that same licensee model to it, so they would basically be taking money out of Nintendo's pocket, or else they would, you know, have some kind of cut of cartridge manufacturing costs as well. I don't know exactly.
I could totally imagine that, like, yeah, the royalty rev share is what ended it, because it's just two huge corporations trying to fight over that.
Yeah,
whereas
Philips
probably didn't have as much of a stake in revenue share of the software.
I don't think it's conjecture. I think it's been reported as fact. I mean, that doesn't stop it from being conjecture, but I've seen it reported, like, oh, this is what happened. Like,
right. Well, and also, you know,
Philips, I've never seen it from a first party source. So
I mean, it's too far back. No one ever talks about this kind of stuff. I mean, it's, you know, ancient history.
Someone tracked down Olaf Olafsson.
But, you know, and Philips was, like, the main inventor of compact disc, right? Like, they're
right, but Sony was the collaborator on the standard.
Right.
So, you know, Nintendo jumped from one CD parent to the other. It was like there was a divorce and they were going to live with mom, but then they decided to live with dad instead.
Well, and, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but CDI had maybe already previously been announced as a thing that was coming before this happened.
Could be.
I'm pretty sure. Because I remember, like, CDI was on my radar, way off the radar, like, even further off than, like, a 3DO or something. And then, like, when Nintendo was suddenly and latched on to CDI, I was like, should I care about this? And like, I spent many months as a kid trying to get excited about CDI and being completely incapable of like even pretending to like trick myself into thinking CDI was anything but abysmal. And I finally, much later in life, because of Mark McDonald, owned a CDI, and it is like an F minus. I mean, the CDI is like among it's the worst terrible. Console ever made. Yeah,
I do remember one thing though about the SNES CD or whatever it was going to be called. Nintendo Power was like priming their audience for mm-hmm. it by like conspicuously
they were like, check
writing.
Out yeah. Phantasmagoria.
It was.
Oh, you're right. Games. Yeah. I forgot about
it was,
that.
It there was. There was a big splash page.
It wasn't Phantasmagoria,
but I still.
It was the seventh guest. Yeah.
Seventh guest.
Same.
Which
same
did,
series.
Which did come out for a CDI.
It did, yeah. But yeah, I mean, it was like they were trying to get me excited about that, and I looked and just saw, you know, an FMV game and said, I don't want that.
Well, and like,
it's not
and like, if you actually go back and play like a Hotel Mario or a Link's Faces of Evil, you know, it is bizarre and strange and hard to believe that ever happened. You know, it's like it's the strangest piece of their history ever, really.
Was Nintendo Power writing about that in the context of this is going to be something you'll play on our system soon? Or were they just like, what are CD games? We're going to look at them. I forget what
it was.
Was.
It was, you are going to be playing this
okay,
soon.
Yeah.
Be excited. CD is here.
So, yeah, instantly the dream of the Super Nintendo PlayStation CD-ROM was over. And instead, we had the CDI nonsense. I think most gamers who had any excitement quickly buried that excitement about and just, luckily, Super Nintendo was so good that it didn't matter that it didn't have a CD-ROM. You know?
So I wonder how far into development that made it. Apparently, even after the Philips announcement, Sony and Nintendo were trying to figure something out in the background mm-hmm. anyway, and it didn't happen. But, you know, reportedly, by a few different accounts, Secret of Mana, which didn't come out until fall of 1993, was originally designed for the Super NES CD-ROM. And one of the reasons it's so glitchy is that there were big chunks of it cut out.
Or like,
I think cutscenes and other content. But
because there's nothing gameplay-wise that would have been benefited really from being on a CD-ROM. Besides,
right.
the music could have been even better maybe than it was.
Right. This is just, you know, going on things that I read. And I think it was an interview. Hmm. I'm pretty sure it was an interview with Ted Woolsey and Nintendo Power.
I think
Power.
I'd heard that too, that it was originally planned
I think
like
it was
a
around,
showpiece for that CD-ROM.
Yeah, I think it was around the time that they were talking about, it was Final Fantasy III, you know, six coming to the US as three. An EGM interview, they talked about Final Fantasy V. We skipped it, but we want to release that as Final Fantasy Extreme someday.
Well,
and Secret of Mana was supposed to be the Sega CD, but you can see where chunks of it were cut out. Look up late 1994 EGMs and see
it's
if you
funny.
Can find that interview. But
in a,
I'm pretty
in a,
sure.
In a world in which the CD-ROM had come out.
In a world in
a
which
world,
the CD-ROM
had
come out.
Yeah, like and like where the Sony PlayStation had not existed ever, you know, had the Sega Saturn come out to fight it or something. It would have been a different battle. You know, Saturn might have had
I can't
had
even
a
imagine. I was as I was putting together the notes for this episode last night, I spent some time as a thought exercise. Like, how would things have been different? And I can't think.
It's hard to think because, like, at the time, because we're almost there. We're almost to the point at which Sony announces, "Hey, we're going on our own. Here's the Sony PlayStation in 1994, and here's what we're doing." And it's at a point at which the Sega Saturn is doing very well in Japan, but doing very poorly in the West, and that you know the Nintendo is, you know, Super Nintendo has lasted way longer than we thought it would, and the games are really good, but it's long in the tooth. And PlayStation comes out with great hardware and a completely new marketing style. It's like, you know, the 90s extremeness is still there, but there's kind of this like classier approach to everything.
Right. It's
right?
like, oh, we recognize that you've grown up.
Right. And like at the time, because I was a diehard Saturn fan, I mean, I was a hardcore Saturn dude. I was very wary of PlayStation because I saw it as a threat to the Saturn's success in Japan because – you know, on paper, it was better. It had better hardware. It was much better at making polygon graphics. The launch titles looked better than, you know, 6 months in titles on Saturn. And then the marketing, I didn't quite get it. It seemed weird to me. I guess I was a little young for it or something. And then, like, looking back now, that launch PlayStation era, just the UI of it, the way the console looks, the way the controller looks, the way the UI looks, like, it was very clean at a time when clean was not the thing to do, you know?
Yeah. No, I remember my first experience with PlayStation was a demo of Wipeout at Toys R Us. And I remember just, like, really being struck by the design of the system.
Right.
And it's so sleek. I mean, it does have that premium Sony look, even though in retrospect, like looking back now, the original PlayStation looks a little clunky and kind of rounded.
At the time, transgressive.
Yeah.
It was.
I mean, Saturn was just like this brick. And N64 went too far with like the weird curve in the front, little like those
like
the
car or something.
Yeah, it was like a weird car, a bad car. It was like the Homer Mobile or whatever.
I thought the PlayStation controller was like over designed, but it really isn't. But it was very weird to me. Like the buttons were weird, and like now
the D pad that was all separate. Yeah, I still hate that.
I did like the D pad, but you know, I think looking back 20 years on, they were so right, and it was a fresh look, and it was a fresh feel, and it felt unlike everything before it. Yeah,
I think it took me a while to get over the controller with legs or whatever you want to call those things. Just like, really? Like, it just...
No, I thought those were great.
They felt good.
Yeah, they were... Like, made a natural way to hold the controller.
I actually had to actually use it, but seeing pictures, I'm like, I don't know how that works. Because I was just used to having, like, a flat, piece of plastic, you know? Yeah.
Well, and like...
You know, all of a sudden, ergonomics came into the picture, and we were like, what the hell?
I want to be uncomfortable.
Well, and Sony also had a unique thing. When they went out to, like, announce their console and announce their launch lineup, they didn't have any of the real known quantity IPs or developers or publishers in their stable.
No, I mean, up until that point, I associated Sony ImageSoft. Sony with ImageSoft. So I associated it with games that were sometimes really good, like they publish Lemmings. Okay, cool. Or sometimes really bad, like, oh, there's Cliffhanger.
Right. So their most valuable partner at the very beginning was Namco. And they weren't Namco Bandai yet. They were just Namco then. And Ridge Racer is SLUS 0001. It's the first game for PlayStation. If you look at the side of any PlayStation, they have numbers. And Ridge Racer is number one. And... you know, I think it was the first game I ever saw for PlayStation was Ridge Racer. And the fact that first version of Ridge Racer looked more solid than any racing game on Saturn, that was it. I was like, wow, okay, these polygons aren't falling apart. And that was, you know, as much as I love my Saturn, it could not stably produce polygons that stuck together without falling apart. It
looked like a bag of Doritos spilled out on the screen.
And like suddenly here was PlayStation like that could accurately represent 3D polygonal arcade games. That was kind of it, you know?
So let's imagine, you know, go back to that thought exercise. The Sony PlayStation happens. I think it probably wouldn't be too far-fetched to imagine that Sony would acquire Nintendo and absorb Nintendo into itself. Mm. And, you know, the PlayStation CD-ROM, you know, might have given Nintendo just enough legs to develop their N64. But the N64 probably would have been less of that weird whatever it was that made, like, bizarre compromises.
Right.
You know, not having a discrete sound processor, so just processing time had to be given over to music. Or, you know, not having enough texture RAM to make things look good. You know, find some happy medium between the N64's strengths, which was, I don't know, fast access speed or something.
Z buffering.
Yeah, yes, Z buffering was good.
A weird controller. Interesting.
More RAM, so 2D games would theoretically have looked better if anyone had ever published 2D games on N64. I feel like they would have come up with some sort of hybrid. I don't know if it would have been more like PlayStation or more like N64. Probably more like the actual real PlayStation.
So we were assuming the Nintendo 64 was already deep in development by the time PlayStation was.
Oh, sure, sure.
Right. So, yeah, like...
Project Reality.
Right. So, yeah, like, Nintendo was going, like, you know, on the wrong side of history. They were, like, doubling down on it, basically, you know? Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot the N64 did right, but it definitely was not in step with the times. It was kind of the Wii U of its day.
Good analogy.
I agree, though.
I was, going back to, like, the important partners around launch of PlayStation, like... You know, in addition to Namco, there were, like, a lot of small little companies that made cool things, like... Exact made Jumping Flash, or you know the team that made Ark the Lad, what were they called? They were called,
whatever they were called.
But like yeah, these smaller little teams who had maybe made an MSX game here or there, something that.
Yeah, I think Exact had worked on X68000 with Geograph Seal, which was basically the DNA of.
Yeah, I think G-Craft is the people who made Ark the Lad.
Yeah, that's
they,
right.
They had helped on some Square thing. I think you know Sony took some risks on smaller Japanese teams and let them make first party content and pushed it pretty hard.
Yeah, we just talked about this on the Shadow of the Colossus Eco episode we just did. Like in the PlayStation era, Sony really just kind of opened itself up and said, let's take some risks. Let's take creative risks. We have this really inexpensive medium we can use. We're free from cartridges and it's more expensive to make games, but it's less expensive to make them, to like ship them and produce them. So they really, they leveraged the creative freedom that came with CD-ROM in a different way. Like, it wasn't just, hey, let's take in a 16-bit game and put some FMV and Redbook audio on it. It was more like, let's, you know, let's parlay the inexpensive nature of the discs themselves to make games that can, you know, afford to only sell 10,000 copies. And that's okay because we're not going to break the bank if they're, you know, well, pretty much a failure.
And I think the strong hardware helped too, because a game like Battle Arena Toshinden by Takara, you know, empirically it's half as good as Virtua Fighter, but it looks twice as good as a Saturn version of Virtua Fighter.
So that was a classic cover of Game Players magazine, just the screenshot of Toshinden. Like, you won't believe these graphics.
Oh, yeah. I remember fighting with all my friends. They were like, oh, man, this game's the best. I'm like, well, no, the graphics are great. The actual gameplay is not so hot. But, like, but yeah.
Sophia was, like, the makeshift mascot for PlayStation for a while, right?
Yeah,
like,
she would make them. She would whip
like,
you.
Check out these triangle breasts.
Yeah, like, the pre-launch U.S. marketing leading up to PlayStation was pretty extreme. Lots of Polygon Man. You are not ready.
There was no familiarity, so they wanted to kind of shock you with, like, you won't believe what this is. Like, you want to be interested
but
in this
weird
thing.
But it did kind of
calm
work.
Down. It did calm down.
Yeah, it calmed down, and it kind of worked. I worked at Electronics Boutique when PlayStation came out. I worked there the day it came out. So I saw it happen. I saw people trading in their Saturns, tons of people trading in their, you know, Genesis and Super Nintendos. You know, the launch lineup was, you know, there were a lot of games. There were probably like 15 to 20 games. And in fact, there were so many games at launch that Sony ran out of jewel cases and had to buy extra jewel cases from Sega. That's why they had the stupid, huge, fragile Saturn jewel cases.
Okay.
Like some of the games. Yeah, like launch era PlayStation, there's actually like four or five different packaging configurations just because it was like a free-for-all, you know, like – Yeah.
There was also the paper cases, too, that had, like, they were the jewel cases, but they were made out of paper, right? Okay.
I
didn't dream that, thank God.
But, yeah, and PlayStation was a huge hit out of the gate here in America. And I think in Japan it took a little longer to take off, maybe. Like, you know, I think it did okay in that December, but it, you know.
I thought that the Saturn actually did really well in Japan for a little while.
Saturn was beating it
and
at first.
Saturn, yes. Yeah. PlayStation came out and it did okay. But it was really neck and neck for a while, and then it launched in the U.S.,
right.
And the Saturn had no traction here, and the PlayStation jumped immediately.
Right.
You know, it was $100 less. It's, I mean, history repeats. This is, it's basically like the Xbox One PS4 situation. I think Xbox One is doing a lot better than Saturn, but it's still like, you know, PS4 is still way ahead of Xbox One, and it is really dominating the industry, and it's on a lot of the same
tactics. What's changed is, like, when this generational shift was happening 20 years ago, what was happening in the world of 16-bit still was, like, on its own track with lots of exciting new releases. Like, obviously in Japan, like, huge things were still coming out for Super Nintendo, Super Famicom, and even Mega Drive after PlayStation and Saturn. But here in America, it seems like now that we're in the gen of PS4 and Xbox One, like, last gen is over. Like,
because last gen lasted so long.
That's true.
Everyone was ready for it to be over. If the current consoles had launched, like, 4 years ago instead of two, I think you would have seen some of the same thing happening.
It's funny. Like, when I think back to PlayStation 1, I brought in a few games that were just, like, in my stack that I thought were important. The first one I always pull out is Tekken 2, because Tekken 2 was the first game I imported for my PS1. And, you know, and this didn't come out until late 95 in Japan. You know, so it was, like, a full year after launch. And I think Tekken 2 was such an amazing port, because Tekken 1 for PS1 wasn't nearly as good as the arcade version. But Tekken 2 was, like, the best arcade port anybody had ever seen. And I think for a lot of people, that kind of set the tone, like, man, this console is changing. And then, you know, not too long after that is when Square finally started to take notice and announced Tobal 1, which came with the Final Fantasy VII demo. And I think that changed everything.
I mean, I was also going to say Dragon Quest going to the PlayStation must have been a huge turning point for the PlayStation in Japan. It was 97.
Yeah, that announcement was it 97 or was it late 96?
I read 96 was when it was announced for the 64DD, and then in 97 they announced that it had moved to the PlayStation. Mm. So,
because I remember reading in the same article in some magazine, I was flipping through it at a, you know, like the newsstand at Walmart or something, reading in the same article that both Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest were going to PlayStation. Mm. And that was, for me, that was like a shot to the gut. I was like, but I, my,
right, because Final Fantasy VII had actually been like announced as a 64DD game with screenshots, right? Like, yeah. Like lock, you know.
And then there was Mega Man, and then there was Castlevania, and I was like, oh my god, all the games I want, like, they're not going to be on N64.
Right. And I think as we're approaching the 20th anniversary of Final Fantasy VII, and with the remake getting announced, you know, coming to PS4, is I think the time for us to really reassess the PS1 era and like the effect of Final Fantasy VII on video gaming is ripe. And I think, you know, we have time to do it. This isn't what this episode is about. But I think, like,
we'll bring you back for the Final Fantasy VII episode.
You'll be back for your Kawazu episode where I can barf on you.
I'm ready for, like, mid to late 90s 3D to be included in the nostalgia pile along with
some of that.
You know, garage shading for indies. I'm all about it, man.
Yeah.
There's some of that happening.
What's that game called? 95? This is
horror. Oh, 90s Racer?
No, you mean just the horror game.
Is it a horror game?
The one where it's like horror 1995?
Yeah, it's just like you just fight the controls like
it basically looks like Resident Evil for Saturn, that one. Yeah,
like getting that aesthetic but with contemporary mechanics and control schemes would be fantastic.
Okay, yeah, kind of going all over the place with PS1. So let's go back to your notes. Okay. Let's go back in time.
Yeah, let's go back in time. Ken Kutaragi surprisingly was not fired when Nintendo said, no, just kidding, Phillips. Instead, for whatever reason, maybe pride or just rage or just a determination, like, this is still a good idea. The company said, okay, let's do this. Let's make a standalone console. And so Sony put together a standalone console that they launched 3 years later, 1994, December 4th, 1994, December 3rd. And it was a really impressive machine. I mean, at the time, until I actually played it and got my hands on it, I was not interested in it. I was not impressed because there were so many competing standards in that era. You know, the Super NES and Genesis were kind of like the main systems. TurboGrafx had faded away. Neo Geo was kind of like this presence that was always in the background for very rich people. But there was, you know, 3DO. There was CDI.
PC
there was
FX
Jaguar. There was the Apple Pippin Atmark.
Right.
There was, yeah. There was all kinds of stuff. Like all these other systems that all seemed like they were trying to do the same thing as PlayStation. They were 3D graphics. They were CD based. They were cool. They were next gen and they were all crap. No offense to, you know, 3DO fans, whatever. But I had no reason to believe that this console from an untested game publisher, like whose software library did not impress me and whose games I did not really want to play, like I had no reason to think this would be the be-all, end-all. This would be the Nintendo killer.
I was like the same way, like, oh, good for them. They made a console too. Well, I'll see what happens. And then I eventually was won over by the Final Fantasy VII thing.
See, I was wary initially, too, because I remember thinking on paper, again, it didn't seem much better than 3DO. And 3DO was $800, and we had it at EB, and I could play Crash and Burn or Need for Speed, and they did look really good, but not $800 good. But then I remember in Game Fan magazine, you know, there was like some beautiful three-page spread showing lots of the games coming out around launch in Japan, and it was like Ark the Lad and some of the other RPGs that made me, because I was just loved RPGs. Like, oh, man, like, I was like, this thing is getting RPGs that you know, and I love RPGs. I was like, if this thing is already launching with RPGs, I will want to have one eventually. I remember thinking that, you know, and like just knowing like as an inevitability, the fact that it has role-playing games, I'm in. And the fact that, you know, like when it, by the time it started to get, you know, it didn't really get RPGs in America for a very long time too. Like Beyond the Beyond was the first RPG. And I beat Beyond the Beyond.
You know, but, that's a feat. Ugh. I couldn't even
How
read
can you
play
anything
of that?
By Camelot?
I almost beat Saga Frontier. Ugh.
What?
Well, there's going to be a fight.
It's gonna be a fight.
Some people just have no taste.
Yeah, beyond.
So yeah, if you look at Sony's hardware on paper, I put this down just for comparison's sake. It doesn't really look that much more impressive than what was out there. I mean, it was a 32-bit CPU. It was a RISC-based chip running at 33 megahertz. So, you know, it had the same amount of RAM and the same amount of video RAM as the 3DO. It had less video RAM than the Saturn.
Wow.
The 3DO had a 32-bit RISC chip running at 12.5 megahertz, so the PlayStation was almost three times as fast. That makes a difference. The Saturn, though, was running on a 32-bit non-RISC chip, the SH2, that was 28 megahertz, so a little slower than the PlayStation. But there were two of them, and there were like all these other weird controller chips inside the Saturn.
I mean,
like theoretically, it should have been really powerful.
People eked amazing performance out of PS1. Like, go look at, you know, Metal Gear Solid or Vagrant Story, you know, or look at a game that runs in high res mode, like Internal Section. Very, very.
Or Tobal 2.
Or Tobal 2. Mm. Tobal 2 is beautiful. Like, yeah, considering how, you know, relatively unpowerful.
Wait, we're just talking about how great Square was right here.
Pretty much.
How about Ape Escape?
Yeah. Escape looks good.
It does. It does look really good. Not that fun, but it looks good.
It's not fun? What is this?
It's not that fun.
What did I walk into?
It's not that
but,
fun.
But, you know, PS1 was a pretty magical thing in that it wasn't hard to make games for it, and the, you know, the media wasn't very expensive either. And, like, I think that's why in Japan especially, like, just so many games. In America, too, like the total list of releases for PS1, it's pretty prolific.
It's like if you – I think it's 7,000 games if you count games released in different regions separately. Yeah. So Final Fantasy VII would count as three games.
I mean, it really was like the – you know, like I think it was the template by which we now judge modern consoles. Mm-hmm. When we think about a great console with ubiquitous giant library full of great things, full of games for niche gamers. I mean, you know, you can buy Revelations Persona. You can buy Madden. You can buy, you know, Konami MSX Archives. You know, it has everything. Like everything's on PS1.
Well, everything. Yeah, if you're importing –
No, a lot of that stuff came in America. Like
MSX Archives?
It came out in America, I'm pretty sure.
It did not.
It might have. There's like tons of Retro Collections games.
No,
out in
it did not.
Okay, maybe the MSX one didn't, but a lot did. But like
and television
know,
did.
There is no genre that was not touched on PlayStation.
Oh yeah. I mean that's to me, PlayStation was in some ways sort of the pinnacle of video gaming. Hmm. And I realize that sounds kind of defeatist, but it was the last time I could go to a store and just see. Even though I was keeping up with game releases, there would be something I'd never heard of that had come out that week or
Jeremy,
like the week before.
Do you have a Steam account? Because that's happening every day.
Yeah, but it's not the
know,
same as
I
going
know.
To the store.
It's,
like,
it's digital, yeah.
Well, this is also,
it's so hard to this, find the okay, good stuff,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, this wasn't pre-internet, but this was internet infancy. You
right.
know, this was like
I was reading PSX Power, thank you.
Right, mm-hmm. we were on news groups. Like things were a little different back then. You know, it was 20 years ago.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I was keeping up with releases, but I would still go to the store and I would just be like, "What is this? This is cool. This is interesting. What is this Parappa the Rapper? What is this Bushido
right.
Blade?"
Well, I'm wearing a Parappa the Rapper
there
button
you go.
That's
right
really
now.
Cool.
I'm wearing MC King Kong Mushi because for me, Parappa was really emblematic of why PlayStation was so amazing. Like, mm-hmm. if Christian was going to be here, he could make it. But
oh, he was on our Parappa episode.
He was on your Parappa
yeah.
episode, and like he and I, we went to our first E3 together down in '96, '97 in Atlanta, and I remember like that's when they were showing Parappa. Parappa, and I got my picture taken with Parappa, and I like, couldn't believe how good it was. I'd seen pictures of it in like Game Fan, but like when I finally played it, I was like, "This is amazing!" I imported it from Japan. It's just the fact that like Sony made that game still as like a mascot game to market.
Not just that they made it, but that they brought it to the
and
US.
Marketed it yeah. in America. Yeah, it's still like to me.
But also a revelation to Parappa the Rappa was that it was $40.
Right.
It launched at $40. I was used to paying $70 for a good Super NES game, $90 for Chrono Trigger. And all of a sudden, you know, Sony started out at $60, and then they said, you know what? We can make $50 our base price. And you know what? When there's a kind of quirky little game that maybe didn't have a huge budget, we can afford to sell that for $40. Meanwhile, right. you know, Turok Dinosaur Hunter.
$89?
$80.
So weird, like,
and it was not nearly as fun as Parappa.
Yeah, N64 games, regardless of genre, would get higher than, like, SNES obscure RPGs like Mortal Kombat Trilogy, $90. Oh. Like, but it's Mortal Kombat.
Well, and I do think, you know, like the fact that on PlayStation 1, $39 price point was a real thing. And then on PS2, $39 was a real price point for new games at some point, too. Like, kind of, it did help to explore new things, try different stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. It was good, very smart.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. That guy's got a text. Satoru Iwata passed away.
Wait, what?
Iwata died.
Oh my gosh.
Holy shit.
Holy shit.
We should take a break. It's probably a good time to take a break.
Oh, okay, so we're back, and tone of this last half of the episode may be a little more downbeat than usual, since we just found out, like, just a couple of minutes ago that Nintendo president Satoru Iwata passed away. Much, much too young, but maybe not too surprising given his recent health problems.
It's still really tragic, and, you know, he hadn't been at E3, so I think people thought that maybe something had been wrong, you know.
Yeah,
but
yeah. I guess for eulogizing briefly, I will say that he was one of the best presidents because he was authentic. He wasn't just a suit, you know. He worked on things like Earthbound and a lot of other games like that, so I appreciate that Nintendo allowed a guy like that to rise to the ranks, a guy who actually knew about games.
He was instrumental in some of Nintendo's early games. He helped make some of their Famicom releases as good as the arcade games, like Balloon Fight. Like, he was the guy, even though he was with another company, they called him in and were like, hey, can you make these games not suck, please?
Yeah, I mean, he was clearly a gamer and just, you know, fully invested and full of energy and friendly. And, you know, he kind of changed the tone of Nintendo's discourse by doing those direct Nintendo Directs and being in front of the camera. And, yeah, I think he'll be greatly missed.
Compared to, like, the shadow government that Hiroshi Yamauchi ran.
Yeah, it was night and day. So I think, you know, he changed the tone of everything over there, and he's going to be incredibly missed. Yeah.
I'm proud that Bob and I have appeared in a photo with Satoru Iwata.
That's true, yeah.
I'm glad we had the opportunity.
While he was still alive, yeah. So R.I.P., I don't know.
This is a Sony episode and really has nothing to do with Iwata, but it just seemed weird not to mark his passing, given that it happened, or news of it broke during this podcast session.
All right, the continuum of gaming moves on, but we always have to remember everything that came before.
Yeah, that's entirely what this podcast is about. So anyway, when last we were speaking, we were talking about just kind of the tech specs of the PlayStation and, you know, how the numbers don't really represent what it could accomplish. I mean, it had some weird quirks. Like, we talked about Z-buffering, and for those who don't know, basically what it means is that the PlayStation had this kind of weird built-in deficiency with rendering 3D graphics. It couldn't it didn't have like a built-in pointer or whatever to handle the things, the perspective of things on the Z axis of the third dimension. So, man, I'm really bad at explaining this. But basically, when you see graphics like warp and distort on PlayStation, the very characteristic 3D quirk of the system.
It's like the ground looks like a waterbed. Like,
yeah,
undulating.
Basically, yeah. Like,
kind of wavy.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like snapping from point to point and distorting. I mean, that's it's the system didn't
like
have the
tessellated?
Math.
Is that the way that we use the word for it? No,
it's
that's not different.
Tessellated.
Okay.
The system just didn't have the math function built into the hardware, and so that was a weird quirk of the system, was that things happening on the Z-axis were always kind of like, I guess, sort of made up on the fly. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it had this kind of weird distorted look. It wasn't as good at handling 2D graphics as the Saturn was, or theoretically the N64.
However, I think
in the right hands,
hands of Gradius Gaiden, I think one of the best 2D games.
Well, yes, Konami made two amazing PlayStation 1 games, PlayStation Symphony or Castlevania Symphony of the Night,
and Gradius Gaiden.
And you know, you said Tekken 2 was the first game you imported. Symphony of the Night was the first game I imported, and the PS1 version of that game looks miles beyond the Saturn version, despite Saturn being technically the better 2D system.
Yeah, for me, I do consider Final Fantasy VII and Symphony of the Night to be like the two games that, like, for me, cemented my love. There's always like, usually there's one game for a console that, like, that's the one, and then your love after those two, I was like, I'm gonna marry my PlayStation.
Yeah, I was a much later adopter than you guys, probably because I'm a little younger and money had more value to me, you know, at that age. But the second I heard FF7 was a PlayStation thing, I immediately started saving money, and that was like, and I got it like the day the game came out, or maybe like a month before. But that's just what sealed the deal for me. Like FF7, I'm there, I'm already in line.
You didn't get into the PlayStation too much later than I did. I bought an N64. I had enough money for one system. I played Mario 64 to death. My roommates played it to death. We played Wave Race. I played Turok and realized
I hated it. You missed my joke. Then you went and bought the other game, Pilot Wind 64. That's what I did.
I didn't, actually. No. I bought one. I was saving up for Shadows of the Empire. And when it finally came out, I realized this game looks like cack. I cannot spend my money on this game.
You're so like, $79.
I bought Turok instead, and it wasn't really better, but at least it wasn't a really bad Star Wars game.
I held on to my Super Nintendo for a long time, but I had friends that had everything, so I would sample all the systems. Like 3DO, that's weird, but I'm never going to buy that. N64, I can just play Star Fox over.
It
and
was
over
a weird
house.
Era where it's like, oh, I'm going to buy, you know, Yoshi's Island and Persona and Shining Force 3 all the same day. It was a weird time. Yeah,
and Harvest Moon for the SNES.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I kept my N64 long enough to get Super Mario 64 or Mario Kart 64, and I sucked every bit of fun out of that I could. I played that thing so much. I was, you know, working on my school newspaper at the time, staying late nights at the office, and my friends and I would, you know, jump in and play a few rounds. And then I realized there's nothing on the horizon that I want. And I looked over at PlayStation, and there was Mega Man two Mega Man games coming, and a third one, Mega Man Neo, whatever that was. That was coming. Final Fantasy was coming.
Was Dash called Neo first?
It was. Mega Man Neo, then Mega Man Nova.
Yeah.
Actually, it might have been Nova, then Neo, then Mega Man Legends.
And you didn't have a Saturn. You were into Sega. Yeah.
I didn't. I saw Saturn, and it just, like, nothing about it interested me.
You're better off, maybe.
Saturn was great for people who were heavily into importing, but I was
that was
at
me.
That
but, like,
point.
But the sad thing, if you were either a Saturn fan or an N64 fan.
I got a Saturn, like, a year later.
Right, but if you were on those other platforms, whether it was if you were on the good club of N64 or Saturn, or if you're on a bad club of like, you know, 3DO or Jaguar, at a certain point, by like mid-1996, end of 96, you were looking at PlayStation with envy. You're like, man, look what's happening over there.
Yeah, I mean, so there were all the franchises that I loved, that crazy-looking Castlevania coming, a bunch of Mega Man games, Final Fantasy, yada, yada, everything except first-party Nintendo, basically. And then there were all these other games that looked so interesting, like Suikoden, this really, like, supposedly a huge RPG with hundreds of characters. That's crazy. Tomb Raider, I want to play this.
Yeah. Oh, and I was like, you know, we're not big Western gamers here, but, you know, what was happening in Europe and especially in America, like, 99 at first-party Sony was really interesting. And, like, you know, we're not huge fans of a lot of these franchises, you know, but, like, people are. People look back on, like, some of that, you know, 989 stuff with, you know, incredible nostalgia for,
Cool
like,
Borders.
Yeah, cool Borders, you know, even, like, Two Extreme, Warhawk,
the top
Twisted
selling
Metal.
Games on PSN are always Crash Bandicoot, like 1, 2,
right.
and 3. That's,
yeah, those are
basically how it
incredibly
works.
Beloved. You know, the Twisted Metal games, like that kind of stuff. Like, there's a lot of, you know, American popular stuff here, you know, on PS1 as well. Yeah. Not for us, though.
I don't know. I think PlayStation was the era where Westerners finally started to get console games. I mean, there were, you know, some good Western developed games on Super NES and Genesis. I'm not saying that there weren't. Maybe even on NES?
Mostly no. By Rare.
Yeah, Rare games.
It was usually ports like Lemmings or right. Prince of Persia.
But not, you know, like original interesting ground-up stuff was coming out of Europe and America yeah. for PlayStation from
I mean,
the ground
up. You had Tomb Raider. Of course, that was multi-platform, but it became sort of defined by PlayStation. It became affiliated
like,
with
you know, Wipeout. Wipeout is beautiful.
Wipeout.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Psygnosis was kind of
Legacy of Kain, yeah, like Super Blood right. Omen. Yeah, there were just all these games that were coming out of Western studios. I loved Herc's Adventure by LucasArts. It was the
all right.
such a yeah. non-LucasArts kind of game in a lot of ways, but it was great. Yeah, so it was really just everything. Like, PlayStation was everything. I know that was PlayStation 3's motto, but no, PS1 did everything except Nintendo games.
We didn't talk about the PS1 motto, right?
You are not ready.
You are not ready, spelled Earnotes. But with a red E. You know how long it took me to get that when I was
a
teenager?
With the E backwards, too, or something?
I think so.
I mean, it was really extreme. Like, the 90s marketing, like, I think, you know, Christian pointed out, like, the Virtual Boy box is, like, the most extreme box. Like, yeah, marketing in the 90s was just very, like, in-your-face, spray-painted, neon, graphic.
For the weirdness. Gen X set, right?
Yeah.
It was a time of comfort and complacence, so we had to be jolted.
It's
in
true.
Order to be engaged.
Hey, idiot, buy something with all your 90s money, you
yeah.
jerk.
Well, and I'll say Sony's marketing back then was very, hey, we are the outsider coming in to like poke fun at the establishment.
Yeah, like yeah. Sega had done that with Nintendo, but it was always kind of mean-spirited, whereas Sony, like, you know, they had Crash Bandicoot standing outside Nintendo headquarters. That was as self-deprecating as it was mocking Nintendo. It wasn't like saying, Mario, you're so stupid. It was more like, hey, look at us. We're silly. We're goofy. Check us out. And, you know, there was kind of a relatability to it. It wasn't like someone saying, we're cooler than they are and you should be part of our cool club. It was more like, hey, guys, let's play some video games. PlayStation.
No, I thought
it was
we dumb. Talk about this?
No, okay.
It was really stupid.
I thought it was a really clever pun on workstation.
I didn't get
I
that.
I still
either.
Do.
Yeah. I never got the workstation thing until much, much later in life. And I was like, oh, it might have even been on Retronauts when I got that. So please look that up.
I get the joke, but I still think it's kind of not that great a name. But it's one of those things that you hear it enough and eventually you're just like, oh, yeah, okay, whatever. Like, it just becomes integrated into life. Like Dreamcast, no one thinks, man, that is such a stupid name. It really is.
I think the hardest thing for me is learning that it's the cross button, not the X button.
K.
canonically it's
cross. Oh, yeah, that's right.
It's cross.
Silly Japanese. You know, and they're thinking the letter X.
If we're just going to like jump around, I do want to mention Netyarose. It's probably come up on another Retronauts in the past, but like it never came out in America. But in Japan, there was a hobbyist console for you to make your own little tiny PS1 games. I thought that was pretty rad.
Yeah.
I mean, I know there were like Devil Dice came out of that, right?
I think I think it got upgraded. Yeah. I think the original version of that Psy was a project from Netyarose. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Sony really tried to reach out to everyone. Game creators. Yeah, I mean, they made PlayStation accessible. You know, they had official PlayStation magazine and every month that came with a demo disc. Again, that wasn't like a totally new idea. You saw PC magazines and Macintosh magazines that did that. But here was a console magazine that did that. And every month you were guaranteed if you paid $8 for this magazine, you would have a couple of hours of entertainment, and you might be turned on to something that you otherwise might not have known about.
Like, that was really appealing.
I picked up the first issue and was not planning to buy the Ghost in the Shell game, but the demo was so cool.
It's by Exact, the makers of Jumping Flash.
And I need to go back and revisit it knowing that because at the time I hadn't played Jumping Flash. But
I feel like
it was a very confusing and bewildering game at the time because I wasn't used to fast action in 3D, but I think now I'd be like all over it.
Demos are kind of like a thing of the past now, but that was a huge thing for me as someone who couldn't buy a lot of games because I didn't have a real job. It was just like even if I don't buy any of these games, I could play this demo disc for like 3 hours and have video games to play, you know. And then I was introduced to things like Tomba, and I replayed Metal Gear Solid demo over and over and over.
Oh, man. I mean, the Metal Gear Solid demo was like an hour long.
Yeah,
it was
a
lot of the game.
It was up to the Hind D, correct?
I think we talked about it. The Arms Tech president having his heart attack.
Oh, yeah, it was that far.
The DARPA chief having his president.
Yeah, you know, demo discs were a really big deal in early PS1. Like, they really were, actually. Like, people coming in just buying the jam-packed discs and stuff. Yeah, like, demos, man.
Yeah. No, I mean, they really hit on all the points. They had a huge collection of varied games. They hit multiple price points.
They had tons of interesting accessories. Like, a lot of them came out in America. Some of them didn't, like Pocket Station. You know, Pocket Station was a big thing, but an interesting thing in Japan that augmented the games with this little add-on device, you know.
They had a one-handed controller.
I have that. The hoary one-handed controller.
Namco alone released so many weird controllers, the JogCon and the NegCon.
The NegCon's so good. NegCon is one of the best controllers
ever. Is that the one that splits down the middle?
Yeah, it has like this amazing feel. Yeah. The buttons are crazy analog, deep buttons.
Yeah, but for racing, it's just like there's nothing else like it.
Oh, PS4.
So much better than a steering wheel.
And like, and you know, for me, the first time I ever went to Japan was 15 years ago. So, you know, PS1 was, you know, on the wane. PS2 existed. But I got to experience what PS1 was like at its peak in Japan. And like, at that point, man, there's a lot of games. There's so many games you've been in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
It was an amazing place.
Yeah, my first trip to Japan was 2001. Yeah. And I was just like,
it was ubiquitous.
Video games everywhere.
Yeah, PS1 was a huge deal in Japan.
So we've talked a lot about the system and kind of our memories and so forth, but I do want to focus on the launch of the system. You know, this is the 20th anniversary of the American launch, but I'd also like to talk about the Japanese launch. That's something that's actually kind of foreign to me. I mean, both of them are. I wasn't paying attention to PlayStation until, like I said, I played Wipeout and started to get fed up with the N64, but... like I just kind of wonder what the reception of PlayStation was in Japan.
I think it was met with pretty good success, not out of the gate wild success, but I rented a Japanese import PS1 a few months after it came out. There was one store where I was going to college that had it, and like it was out. You know, I had to put my name on a list. I finally got it, so I did get to play Ridge Racer and I think one other game early on. And at that time, it did feel. I remember, like, after having played Saturn, it did feel slightly better and newer. And I was like, okay, people came in and saw it and were impressed by it. And I think in Japan, it had that feeling too, that like people knew that Sega Saturn, although was doing fairly well, wasn't the next big thing. And I think people were looking for another answer that wasn't, NEC or 3DO. And, Sony is a very respected corporation. Like, they've been shipping high quality electronics for a long time. And I think there's a lot of nationalistic pride behind Sony. So I'd imagine there was some, internal desire for it to succeed.
Despite Nintendo's, actually maybe because of Nintendo's betrayal, there might have been a little bit of underdog there as
potentially,
well.
So
there were 8 games released in Japan on December 3rd, 1994. There was Ivy Evolution.
That's Take the A Train.
Is that what it's called?
It is. That's a Take the A-Train game.
Oh, okay. Okay. It looks like SimCity. It's Maxis.
It is. Yeah, Maxis published the A-Train games. Yeah.
Okay, so it was Art Dink published by Maxis.
Yep. It was a launch title here in America as well.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was the same thing.
Same thing.
Okay. Crime Crackers.
Sadly never came, neither Crime Crackers 1 nor 2 never ever came out in America. They're not that good, though.
I like the box art, but
The name is great and the artwork is great, but it is a pretty much generic.
If you're a fan of silent debuggers for PC Engine, you'll like this.
It is very much like the same developer.
They're all listening to this.
And for some reason, it has like anime-style portraits of anime-style cat girls at the bottom of the screen.
I own this game. You don't have to.
So who is the cracker?
Actually, I have Crime Crackers 2, and I think I played it once. I don't really remember.
Oh, there's a sequel.
There is.
There's Bob's personal favorite, Parodius Da Deluxe Pack.
I have the Saturn version. It's fantastic. Yeah.
How was the PlayStation version in comparison?
It's a little slower. I think it runs in a window. Hmm. I really enjoyed your Proteus episode.
Oh, thank you.
I'm a huge Proteus fan.
I love Proteus.
Though you didn't talk about Sexy Proteus enough.
My favorite is the second one.
Sexy Proteus is my favorite Proteus.
Gokujo.
Yeah. I also didn't talk about the strategy RPG, but the less said about that, the better.
Para Wars?
Yeah.
The Japanese launch also saw two, not one, but two Mahjong games, which I didn't even bother to write the names down for because they're
Mahjong,
all the same.
They're Mahjong games.
Neketsu Oyako, which is a Technosoft-developed brawler with 2D graphics.
Oh, it's not very good.
It doesn't look very good.
No, I've
Technosoft
played.
Is not a brawling
Christian
brawler.
Christian owns it. It's
Technosoft made shooters, yeah, not brawlers.
It's of note, though. I mean, it's one where I kind of forgot that game because thanks for reminding me.
It's weird, though, because you had this Technosoft game working outside their wheelhouse at the Japanese launch. And then in America, you had the Raiden games. Wasn't that all? No, that wasn't Technosoft.
Raiden Project came out here, published by Sony at launch.
Yeah, but who's the developer on Raiden?
The original developer of Raiden? They have a weird name, Toplan or something?
Oh, Toplan? Okay.
I might be wrong. The Japanese PS1 launch is a little bit of a mess.
Never mind. I was thinking for a second that Technosoft did them, but Technosoft was Lightning Force and Thunder Force.
Thunder Force.
And Lightning.
Erzog's Vi.
Lightning.
Yes, Lightning. There was Tama, Adventurous Ball in Giddy Labyrinth.
Tama was also a launch game for Saturn. It's terrible.
It is.
It's a puzzle game.
Well, it's a 3D labyrinth game.
Not good.
It's like the wooden labyrinth.
Yeah, man, a bad launch. Yikes.
Is anyone doing Cron Sony? Because this is
we'll get there.
Ridge Racer was there day one.
And I was going to end with Ridge Racer because that was the game.
That was like the game you bought.
But I love Tama, just the name. Adventurous Ball in Giddy Labyrinth. It's very much like Dig Outer's Adventure and Halcyon Days.
I think Ark the Lad came out like 2 weeks after launch or something. It was shortly thereafter.
It was shortly after.
And like,
but it
right,
wasn't at
right
launch.
After launch was Philosoma, which is a shooter that I think is actually pretty good from Sony.
I like Ark the Lad. The first game, isn't it like 5 hours long?
3 hours
it's
long.
Really, it's
if
a
you
shortest
do the,
RPG.
If you do the extra dungeon, which
did,
is pretty important, it's like 15 hours.
Yeah.
But you need to play it. It's kind of like Suikoden 1 and 2. Like you play it and you get through it really quickly. And then you use that save file data to play the much, much deeper and much better sequel. So
when I retire,
right. when Working Designs later put out the Ark the Lad collection, that is fantastic, actually.
Yes. Yeah, I was all over that.
Victor did a good job with that one.
And I'm really happy those showed up on PSN to play
it,
on
it
PSP.
That's
and
right.
Vita. Yeah. So there's no reason not to play the Ark the Lad games.
Right.
They're excellent.
One of my secret favorite launch era PlayStation 1 titles is a fighting game. It came out in America as well as Japan called Zero Divide. It's by Zoom. It's basically a Virtua Fighter with robots, and it has a pretty good frame rate and it has textures. And it was like way better than Toshinden Sigurumai.
My note here is that Zero Divide is a poopy 3D fighter.
You're wrong.
Okay.
It's quite good.
So then finally, at the end of that Japanese release list, you had Ridge Racer.
Ridge Racer, which was fantastic.
And even though in contemporary standards, Ridge Racer seems very lacking, it is a one-course racer.
Well, I think what's astonishing is the delta between Ridge Racer on PlayStation and R4. That's on the same console. And like R4 is like 10 times the content, literally.
R4 is just an amazing game.
Yep.
It is absolutely tremendous. I don't even like racing games,
right. But
R4,
everybody respects R4.
R4 is so good. I picked it up just on a whim and was just like,
God, they should announce R5, pretend like the Ridge Racer 5, 6, 7 ever happened.
Yeah, that series really
went off the ridge.
Yeah, really sad. So anyway, yeah, not a very good launch in Japan, but compared to the Saturn launch.
Right, and they had like the one really good game. As long as you have one really good game, right, then you're not.
And it was an arcade quality, not a perfect port, but damn close.
Yeah,
and there was, I mean, you know, compare that to what was the Saturn racer,
Daytona, and it was I love Daytona.
No, Daytona was good. There was another one before that
on Saturn,
wasn't there?
No.
Okay, so maybe I'm thinking of Daytona, but. Like the two side-by-side, there was no comparison.
Like when you say right now, oh yes, Virtua Fighter Daytona are fine on Saturn, if I were to boot them up, you would be like, I was so wrong. Like things are falling, like, you know, polygons are collapsing in front of you.
Yeah, but Daytona has a song. Daytona.
Let's go away. That only gets you so far.
That's true.
But like, bear in mind that
that's
both,
good for the title screen.
Both Virtua Fighter and Daytona were both like re-released with fixed versions on Saturn. But then again, Ridge Racer was kind of re-released as a fixed version as well. But
yeah, that whole like Ridge Racer, Rage
Revolution.
Racers,
Ridge Racer Revolution. Yeah. Rage Racer is a different game and really pretty, actually.
And not to be mistaken for Ray Tracers.
No, which is also on PS1.
Yes. Man. It's very that's like kind of obvious.
You know, I'm like skipping ahead like a year and a half, but I remember buying Wipeout XL, aka Wipeout 2097, the second Wipeout, and that game is unfathomably good. Because like the first Wipeout, while pretty, was unplayably hard. Like no one actually liked it, but then Wipeout XL was like beautiful and fun and easy, and everyone, it's so good, like a 10 out of 10. Perfect game. Anyway,
phenomenal. So, okay, that was December 3rd, 1994. Jump ahead to 20 years ago now, September 9th, 1995, and you have the American launch, which is much better. But what really I find interesting about the American launch is people are always talking about how Sony hated 2D games and were like, no sprites on PlayStation. But if you look at this list, there's like four games out of 10
like right in
that are two.
Right in project published by Sony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had NBA Jam Tournament Edition, Rayman, The Raiden Project, and Street Fighter the Movie. All of them were 2D games.
Street Fighter the Movie, I'm not going to vouch for that one here. You can cosplay as Captain Sawada as much as you want, D-Frog. It's not going to make the game any better.
It was at least developed by Capcom, though.
Unfortunately.
Oh, man, they didn't even farm it out?
The arcade game was developed by an American developer.
Yeah, I thought so.
But then for the PlayStation version, it's actually a different game.
Yeah.
Let's put our name on this.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird one. But
I'll tell you, the big sellers at EB in Kentucky back in September of 1995 were, of course, Toshinden, Ridge Racer, and I believe ESPN Extreme's Downhill. That was a big hit. A lot of sellers for that one. Mortal Kombat 3 also.
So the launch titles were, in alphabetical order, Air Combat, which is sort of the predecessor to Ace Combat.
And it's a good game.
It was competent. Battle Arena Toshinden, which we've mentioned, not really that great, but it looked good.
Right.
It looked really good.
And it was in all the marketing, and like it seemed like, oh man, this game looks amazing.
Well, and you held it up to Virtua Fighter 2 on Saturn, and you were like, oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And considering it's by Tamsoft, it's actually pretty good for them. But
Tamsoft didn't have a lot of hits under their belt. They did that, and they did Guardians Crusade.
Oh, that was them? Okay.
That dopey RPG that was not very good.
You mean Knight and Baby, that game?
Yes, Knight and Baby. NBA Jam Tournament Edition, which we talked about recently on a Williams episode, Midway and Williams.
It's fun.
Power Serve Tennis, which I didn't actually get to play, but I watched videos of it. And from what I can tell, it might be the worst tennis game in history.
Wow.
That's saying a lot.
So they were like, 3D graphics, we can do it. It's crazy. Check it out. So from what I can tell, like you play as the character in the foreground, and the camera constantly like jumps forward or jumps to the side, so you no longer see the player character. Maybe I'm wrong, and maybe you play as the character in the background, but in any case, like the collision detection is terrible. I was watching videos where Like, the guy in the foreground would hit the ball with his racket and it would pass right through. But, you know, the guy in the foreground vanishes off of the camera pretty frequently. So you don't even know where he is relative to the ball.
Wow,
so
who published it?
I didn't bother to look
that up. I think it might be Acclaim or something.
It might have been, or Ubisoft.
Wow. Not a classic.
Not a classic. Ubisoft also published Rayman, which is a classic. I'm not that big a fan, but it was well done, and it's better than Rayman Legends.
Yeah. Wow.
Ridge Racer, of course. Street Fighter the Movie, which was Capcom's take on someone else's take on their movie take on their video game.
Only 2 years after the movie opened, right? No, just 1 year. Yeah.
I have a story about that game.
Go on.
Real quick. I had rented it because I wasn't going to buy it, and I was playing it. And for whatever reason, you can't pause that game. You can't pause. And, like, the doorbell rang, and I go to, like, ring with the doorbell. And, like, Chun-Li is getting attacked. And as she's getting attacked, she's, like, moaning. And I'm like, And then, like, it's two Jehovah's Witnesses at the door. And all they hear is this woman moaning, and they give a weird look. And I'm like, it's not what it sounds like.
So it sounds like that thing did you a favor, though.
Maybe. Okay. I close the door.
So there was Street Fighter the Movie. There was the Raiden Project, which we mentioned.
Classic.
The Raiden Project is not only is it a pair of good shooters, but it's also pretty much the only way to play Raiden 2 at home.
I think you're right, yeah.
Because I was just watching – you asked if there was a Crontendo equivalent for PlayStation. Yes.
Yeah.
Danny Cowan, a.k.a. Sardius, has started up something called PlayStation Year 1 where he's going through the U.S. library.
Is that on YouTube?
It is.
Oh, cool. I have to watch
that. Check out Adventure Pals is the name of the channel. He's several games into it at this point. But yeah,
good luck with Saga Frontier, motherfucker.
That was beyond year one.
Yeah,
Saga Frontier is so good.
Oh,
so the thing about Raiden 2 is that it was really heavily encrypted to the point that I think it's only just now been cracked for MAME.
Wow,
like it is 2015. This game is from the early 90s. Yeah. And it has been inaccessible in MAME, which is also almost 20 years old.
You're making me want to pull up my copy of the Raiden Project and play it tonight. Mm.
So, you know, it's a really good top-down shooter. One of the earliest sort of compilation titles, actually, that attempted to give arcade-perfect ports of these games. I don't know if it was quite arcade-perfect, but still, you know, really good. Surprisingly kind of a U.S. release, I think, for launch, but I'm glad it came out. Total Eclipse Turbo, which is a very mediocre-looking rail shooter.
It's all the 3DO game,
yeah,
right?
All the Crystal Dynamics 3DO ports were, like, the first games we got. Remember, we got Off-World Interceptor Extreme and Total Eclipse Turbo, like, 3 or 4 weeks before PlayStation came out in our stores.
Wow. Yeah.
And then, finally, there was Zero Divide, which I think is poopy-looking,
so
but
good.
Shane disagrees.
So good.
So, who do you believe, me or Shane?
Let's have the fans weigh in on this one.
That's right. Let's vote now.
I think another
thing.
Use your phones.
Now.
Text Retronauts.
I was talking about how totally sweet the packaging is for PlayStation games in Japan, especially first-party ones. But I think even in America, the fact that they were on the cool black CD-ROMs made them seem special and badass.
This is a PlayStation Black Disc.
I think we covered this. That color was chosen for that reason, right?
It was actually very dark blue, but yes.
Yeah, to look distinctive. There was no other reason, correct?
It looks badass.
It's like when you bought CDRs in the late 90s and like some of them were pink and like blue and yellow.
I really loved that when a game came out on CD for PlayStation 2, which was very rare, but occasionally it happened, it also had a blue disc.
Yeah.
Just as kind of like a last, hello, yes, remember us? I don't think that would work on DVDs though because the laser was blue, wasn't it?
I think you're right.
So it would have been impossible to read.
Even though there's a whole episode of Retronauts dedicated to retro collections, I did want to bring up the Namco Museum because I do think that like Namco Museum started fairly soon, you know, probably within year two. And
I think it was year one.
Maybe it was year one. And I imported all six of them and loved them. And for me,
in Japan it might have been year two, right. But in America,
you know, it set the tone again. Like, wow, this is a place of our archiving. This is like, you know, that hadn't happened before.
Did you get the Namco Encore? Or not,
I did.
Not Namco Encore. Namco,
I got the anthology.
Namco Collection.
I got the anthologies 1 and 2. I also have the whole set for my museum with the, you know, with the six disc.
Wow, aren't you fancy?
With the registered trademark symbol and all that.
Yeah, I ended up getting rid of mine when they started coming out with those compilations for other systems. And I regret that because they were a really nice set.
Well, and you know
Namco, N-A-M-C-O,
you know, Namco,
and the trademark.
Namco 3, the M1, is like one of the best-selling PS1 games of all time.
Yeah. I mean, they reissued that and Volume 1.
And Ms. Pac-Man.
Yeah,
they released those as greatest hits. Yeah. Meanwhile, finding 2 and 4 is almost impossible.
2 is so good. Super Pac-Man, QDQ, what are you going to do?
Four, of course, has Tower of Jiraga and Return of Ishtar.
See, I think, yeah, like, I think I look back on Namco Museum, my heart just fills with, like, weird, like, nostalgia for PS1, which we, it's like retrograde nostalgia. I love it.
I think it's officially nostalgia, right?
It's nostalgia, it's
like,
for nostalgia?
It's like meta nostalgia.
Yeah. I guess so. It's weird. It's weird classic.
I remember these I mean, actually, those games were newer when they were compiled than they than the Namco Museum is.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's so weird.
Yeah. We're all dying.
Welcome to die.
Oh. Well, and I wonder if, like, if you're like a kid, if you're some awesome kid right now who's like 14, how easy is it to find all these old PS1 games? Because you can still play them, luckily, on a PS3 and on a PS, you know, like, you can play these games at least pretty easily.
Namco hasn't released its museum games for PS1, has it? Actually, has Namco released?
Oh, you mean digitally?
Yeah.
Oh, some of them. I'm talking like the actual physical.
Oh.
Like, if you're like a person who actually wants to collect things and play them the real way, it's not so hard. I feel like PS1 hasn't become, you know, like, prohibitively expensive.
Some of the games that were prohibitively expensive became so right away. Like Valkyrie Profile, before the system was dead, that game was expensive.
Right.
Suikoden 2, that game was expensive. And they've actually come down in price.
Well,
Not because
of the digital releases.
Even
either.
Suikoden 2 was coming down in price before the digital release. Right. Like, for a while, it was selling for $250.
Wow.
And it was down to, you know, like $160 or so, which is still a lot, but, you know.
But I feel like the line.
My perspective has changed now that I'm trying to buy a lot of Game Boy Complete and Box games. That gets expensive, let me tell you.
Yeah, boxes for anything that old. But I think, like, if you're just someone who doesn't care that much about the box and docks, for just finding working PS1 discs, most aren't going to be too expensive.
Assuming that you can find them that aren't scratched to hell. Right, that's the challenge.
That is.
That system, those discs were very fragile. Including, like, I imported, like I said, Symphony of the Night, first game I ever got. That had beautiful disc art, and I don't know what happened, but I lent the game to someone, and it came back scratched and no longer would play. So I had to have it resurfaced, and what I didn't realize is that the resurfacing would wipe off most of the disc art.
Yeah.
Did you bring it to the game doctor?
I don't remember who I took it to, but it was a jackass.
Game doctor was this weird peripheral that would, like, scrape a layer off the CD.
I think that's what it was, pretty much. But it scraped off the beautiful disc art.
That's the kind of peripheral that in, like, 20 years, children won't believe. Like, do you remember Grandpa Bob had to buy this device to scrape off the stuff on a CD-ROM?
It's like you're whittling a CD on the front porch.
Yeah, I mean, it's like any generation. There's always these kind of unique things that pop up around the system to alleviate its flaws. For instance, you had a memory card in the shape of Lara Croft.
Right.
Why would that exist? But it did.
Well, or, you know, like, you know, I don't want to disparage the hardware in any form. I thought it was amazing hardware, but eventually my original PlayStation from day one, from launch.
Well, the day one systems were the most vulnerable.
My day one launch system eventually didn't read games so well, and I had to I actually bought a new drive, like, from NCS. They're still around. It was like 20 years ago. Bought a replacement CD drive and installed it myself and, like, fixed my PS1 for like $50. I was really impressed. Like, I'm not even very savvy, but, like, it literally just, like, set in. Like, but yeah, like, after like 7 years of playing it every day, it stopped working.
I just would turn mine on the side, and then eventually I had to turn it upside down.
Yeah, a lot of people had theirs upside down.
Yeah. Yeah. The earlier systems apparently were built with a plastic rail system that would melt because of its proximity to the laser. So, yeah, not so good. But later ones were built with metal. But the thing is, those early systems, the fragile ones, supposedly are some of the greatest CD players ever made.
Really?
Like, the audio quality on those is reputedly just, like, top-of-the-line, high-end CD player.
Hmm.
I've never tested that for myself. Right. But
well, it's like the launch PS3 players. Launch PS3s are the best. That CD player is a Super Audio CD player.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wait, have you guys, either of you guys, done the swap trick? We haven't talked about this. I never did.
I did.
Okay. I had mine modded.
I did. When I first got this Tekken 2, I was swapping. I was swapping with a piece of Silly Putty, and it worked pretty well for a while, but it just got really annoying of having to do that swap, so I eventually got it modded.
Yeah, and we only brought up mods now. It was, like, this one of the last systems to, like, get modded so heavily. It just, like, it felt like such a
GameCube was modded.
Just a Switch. It was very simple.
Right. I had friends with, like, modded Xboxes, but that was just to pirate games. But, yeah, like, in terms of doing imports, like,
I never pirated with my modded PS1. I just imported
games. The PS1 import scene was so huge.
It was so good.
Huge, so good. Probably the best.
But
ever.
It got really annoying when they started doing the lockout stuff. They would you had to like buy a Game Shark, plug it into the back of the system, wait for someone to release a code to allow you to break the circuit.
I remember like Dino Crisis was with like the first game to have that lockout.
I don't know. The Mega Man Legacy Collections had it, or the not Legacy Collections, the Complete Works.
Yeah.
Eventually, like after 1999. Every game had it. So it just became a thing. Like, you had to wait for someone to release.
Every game had a unique lockout.
Right.
Like,
it was like a new code for each game. And, you know, it would take like 24 hours for someone to Dex Drive it and get it up on.
Dex Drive.
That's a word I haven't heard.
Wait, help me out. Dex Drive. What was that?
Oh, actually, no. It was on Dex Drive Central or something like that.
Dex Drive was like a game shark that used 3.5-inch diskettes.
Oh, boy. Not zip drive stuff?
No, it was a way to let you back up your memory cards.
I thought so. And download saves, too, right? Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, someone would game shark the codes within 24 hours, and then you would just have to punch it in. But you could set, like, game code memory information. My words. You could program the Game Shark to have the codes for a game. So you didn't have to re-enter it every time. You would just say, oh, I want to play Legend of Mana. Go to the Legend of Mana code. Here's the import lockout.
God, I totally forgot about that. And now I'm remembering having to go through that process to play like Parasite Eve 2 or something terrible. You know, like.
I remember just the idea of a memory card took me maybe a few days to understand, like, because I wasn't used to it. And then, like, I remember renting, I was like, I can't rent Breath of Fire 3 because then someone will overwrite my save. And I was like, oh, that's right, I have a memory card. I can just rent this, like, every other week if I wanted to.
I understood it because Neo Geo had it for no good reason. But, like, that template of, oh, a memory card is a thing that could exist.
Something like, put it into an arcade machine. Like, I mean, that was the wild. Reason for that. Yeah, I thought so. But, like, yeah, that concept, what was it, like, 1 megabyte of flash memory? 2 megabytes of flash memory?
1 megabit, I think.
1 megabit, wow, okay.
Yeah, and it was very slow. That was the Achilles heel for Vagrant Story because whenever you wanted to do mods on your weapons to, you know, to fuse them in the workshop, it would have to access the memory card. So it was like 3 slots on the memory card. So it would sit there and load it in.
Or I remember the horror of Monster Rancher requiring an entire memory card.
That's right.
15 slots. That's like $25. I was a kid. I was like, man, that's...
I remember there were rumors that Final Fantasy VII would require a full memory card.
One slot.
Yeah. I was like, you liars. I bought a second memory card just because it was going to be so big.
God.
I was like, I've got to have a separate memory card for Final Fantasy VII.
The fact that
I just wasted 17.
The fact that you made in my brain the image of that heinous, hideous Lara Croft memory card come back... Like, you need to put a picture of that in the show notes.
It's like a real doll is coming out of your PlayStation.
Oh,
like a hideous, horrifying, like...
And the idea that, you know... Like,
not even a real doll.
The idea that all of this was, like, you know, 15, 16, 17 years ago. It's like, wow.
Yeah, so we're actually running low on time, so we have to kind of wrap this up. But there's a lot we could say about PlayStation. We could probably do a second episode that's just, like, post-launch PlayStation memories.
It was the last sticker-friendly system.
That's true.
Like lid stickers, button stickers, memory card stickers.
I
mean, anything is sticker
ready.
No,
that lid was perfect. I have a big old smiley face.
I think
on
the
mine.
PS2 monolith is pretty perfect for stickers too. I gotta say, the original PlayStation 2, it's like a monolith.
Yeah.
It's like flat and full. It's good with stickers.
There's something about that I just can't mark up though.
It's too pristine. Like the PS1 is like divided into little chunks that you can be like, there's a sticker for that thing. And then, you
know. I just found my awesome Moo Moo sticker in my copy of Jumping Flash 2. I think I'm gonna stick it on my PlayStation 4.
That's a good idea.
But yeah, like I'll say, like reminiscing about PlayStation 1 20 years ago, at first it didn't seem that long ago, but now the more we talk about it, it does seem that long ago. And I also feel like the DNA of PlayStation, you can see it all there. It was all there. And like it was a little bit like less polished and kind of, you know, scrappy. But I think as someone who works at PlayStation now, who has like, you know, worked on the launch of PlayStation 4, it's like I think we looked really heavily back to the beginning of PlayStation 1 and like what got us to where we were when we were thinking about the philosophy to approach PlayStation 4 with.
Well, it seems to have worked. It's been a huge success. So I think that was the right place to look. And it is a good place to look. The PS1 really was a revelation for video games. It really did represent, I think, not just technologically, a new kind of threshold for games, but also just in terms of how they were made, how they were marketed, the kinds of games, the breadth and depth of games. PS1 was really kind of video gaming coming of age in a lot of ways.
One thing I forgot to bring up, that like about 2 or 3 years into PS1, in Japan, Sony Japan started to try to market Western games to Japanese people. They called them Yoge, and it was a huge failure, but they did try it. And like, you know, 17 years later, now it works. Now games like Destiny and Call of Duty and GTA sell really well over there.
What does
like,
the Yo stand for in Yoge?
Euro.
Euro? Euro? Okay.
Yeah. But like the fact that Sony was trying that in its home nation all back at PS1 is kind of fun to look at.
Mm.
Yeah. Anyway.
So, final thoughts on PlayStation. What is your favorite PlayStation memory, Bob?
Ooh. I think, and this is going to be the lamest, most obvious thing ever, but I think it is popping in Final Fantasy VII and seeing all the Final Fantasy things I knew in this 3D world. Like, as simple as it looks now, that was just like, hey, it's like the spells I've been using. It's like the weapons and items I've been using, but they're all like fully realized in 3D, and this is going to be the future from now on. So that's kind of what it was for me, just popping it in and like almost being late for high school the day after I got it. Just like, I want to play more. So, yeah. It's a very obvious memory, and I did not cry when Aerith died because I already knew about it because of news groups. So screw you, Guybrush Threepwood, whoever you are, who spoiled it on Alt Games Final Fantasy. Yep.
And Shane.
I would like to say something from Final Fantasy VII or Nocturne, but actually it's probably the first time I ever beat Umjammerlammy.
That's great.
Umjammerlammy is my favorite PlayStation game.
Did you know that there was a Parappa game hidden on the disc, or was that a surprise to you? I'm just curious.
I didn't know going in, and I think it's cool that it's on there, but it's, you know, I'd much rather play as Lammy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
I think for myself, it was getting the Chrono Cross demo disc and, you know, importing it and taking that game home from work over my lunch break and playing it and recording it and just like strip mining it of content and sharing that with the GIA. And basically just realizing this is fun. This is something I want to do as opposed to just like, hey, it's like, nice to have a video games website.
Like actually covering editorial games that people care about in a meaningful way, like yeah. in a timely fashion.
Yeah.
Actually, Jeremy, like, did you host like MP3s from that demo on your website?
I did.
Okay.
Well, that music is the bomb.
It is, but those MP3s I put on the first CD-R I ever had burned.
Wow.
The very first one. It was just video game music.
He put on a mixtape that he made his first girlfriend.
No, I wouldn't have a girlfriend for several years until...
It was great. I just stood there and recorded music while it played in the background.
That's awesome.
And put up some MP3s. There were videos on GIA, and then I did some write-ups and stuff. Yeah, it was just like that game really pulled me in, even though I know it made a lot of people angry.
Yeah,
I really, really liked it, and the process of you know, dissecting it, really, it was kind of revelatory for me.
Wow, I'm just glad that your best memory did not involve the poisonous touch of Ashutoshi Kawase.
Wow.
Didn't it?
I don't think he touched it too directly.
Hmm.
He might have walked by, put his power
over it. There
are
things about Chrono Cross that are very Kawazu-ish.
Oh,
like
for sure.
The cast of, you know, misfit nonsense characters.
Yes.
Yes.
And the very complex mechanics, the element system, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, white is the opposite of like purple, I don't even know.
black, come on. Anyway, I think that wraps it up for this episode. We've covered a lot of ground. So yeah, PlayStation, 20 years old in America, even older in Japan. And definitely, like I said, kind of a landmark for video games. So, thanks for everyone for listening. Shane, thanks for coming in. Where can people find you on the internet?
On the internet, people can find me on Twitter at Shane Watch. That's all one word, Shane Watch.
And what is your title, your role at Sony?
I am a senior account manager of developer relations. I help sign up independent developers for PlayStation.
So you are in charge of the new Parappas
and
the new Katamari Damacy's.
No, I don't do the first party stuff like a Parappa. I do the independent third party stuff, but I also do help. I have a little bit of touch on some of like the classics and stuff, and I do help fight to get classic PS1 and PS2 games help put out and stuff. So I definitely
such as Saga Frontier.
That's not one of them, but like I do.
God,
for
damn
example,
it, Shane.
I work with like Monkey Paw and SNK, and like yeah, it's a lot of.
I think Shane is actively fighting against Saga Frontier. Like I heard there's some weird stuff on that disc.
Saga Frontier 2, I like that one better. How about that one? No?
I don't like either one. I'm sorry, Jeremy. I'm not as virulent about it or malevolent about it.
Have you ever tried Saga Frontier?
I bought Saga Frontier.
Have you ever played it?
Yes.
How many characters did you make it through?
I tried all of them, and then I realized...
How many did you finish?
Zero.
Wow. I finished four, and then I wanted to destroy everybody in the world.
I made it to the final boss of Acellus and couldn't beat it because I didn't understand the mechanics, but I still love it.
I made it a lot further in two, but
that game would be so good on Vita. It would just be perfect.
Oh, my God.
Make it happen, Shane.
You just made things worse, Jeremy.
Anyway, Bob.
Oh, yeah, I'm Bob Servo on Twitter. You can read my stuff at US Gamer. Please do. I also write for Something Awful. And I'm on another podcast called Talking Simpsons, and where we go through every episode of The Simpsons in chronological order. There's an episode for every episode of The Simpsons. It's on LaserTime's Patreon, so go to patreon.com/lasertime. And if you donate, you'll get to listen to that podcast, and I like it a lot.
I didn't know you had that podcast.
It's a secret.
Is it only for Patreon people?
The first season, yeah. But then after that, because we don't think people care about the first season, but I think they're fun to talk about, at least.
Do you have, like, a season zero where it's all Tracy Ullman?
No, because those are really hard to – I mean, they're not – hard to find, but they're horrible to watch because they're all like recorded off VHS from like 1988.
I'd like to watch them again because I remember being a kid and liking them.
There's a supercut on YouTube. Just search
right,
for that.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So season one is where Homer talks like this. He's just, he's not like this.
He's really dumb.
Boy.
Yeah, he's kind of mean.
It's like Jackie Gleason and Walter Matthau. I was like, hey, boy, let's go out and play football.
And at some point, Dan Castellaneta is like, oh, maybe I should talk like this. It's funnier.
And that was a choice for the best, I think.
Yeah, okay.
Where can we find you, Game Boy Frog?
Game Boy Frog.
I called you Game Boy Frog.
Yeah, you did. That would be for the frog the bell tolls, I believe. Where am I? Oh, right, usgamer.net. I'm on Twitter as GameSpite. I have a website called GameBoyWorld.com and also a YouTube channel under the name Toasty Frog, hence that Game Boy Frog thing that Shane said. Anyway.
The internet never goes away.
Did we talk about how to give us money?
We didn't.
We should.
You can find Retronauts at Retronauts.com, also on US Gamer, on Twitter as Retronauts, Facebook, YouTube, SoundCloud, iTunes, all as Retronauts. You should subscribe to us and listen to us and give us good reviews.
If I only were to donate pennies a day, would I still have access to episodes an entire week early?
Yeah.
If you donated 3 pennies per day, no, 2 pennies per day.
It's literally a quarter a week, and someone actually complained about that on the internet.
I think a quarter a week seems like a steal.
A dollar a month. You can listen to our episodes a week in advance, and sometimes I take our cover art and make it into wallpapers.
All right.
It's good stuff.
Anyway, yes, so please support us on Patreon so that we can continue making high-quality podcasts as opposed to shouting at one another across the country via Skype and being awkward and weird. Like, if we're awkward and weird now, at least it's because of innate flaws and not because of the recording
good.
Methods.
I thought I was going to have to leave.
Nope. We're okay. So anyway, thanks everyone for listening. Hope the middle of the podcast wasn't too much of a downer. Pour one out tonight or drink a toast to Satoru Iwata and his memory.
Go back and play some classic HAL games.
Yeah, play some Balloon Fight and some Kirby. And anyway, we will be back in 1 week with a Retronauts micro episode. Thanks, everyone.